Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks and my guest today is Keith Thomas, who is the writer-director of a new IFC Midnight feature, The Vigil, coming to you February 26th on various platforms. I can't name them all anymore. Hi, Keith.
Hey, good to be here.
Now, this film is very intriguing. You actually did an extreme amount of research into Jewish religion, Jewish culture, Hasidic culture specifically, and folklore into Jewish perspective on demons and monsters, I'm going to say, yeah. If I have that correct. So The Vigil actually made the rounds of the film festival circuit in 2019, correct?
Right. Yeah, we had our premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival in the Midnight Madness section in September 2019.
And what has the film been doing between then and now? Because I want to know where its path of right. audience reception has been before I dive into the good stuff.
Sure. No, yeah, kind of it had its premiere and it got picked up for worldwide release essentially right as the pandemic hit. Kind of through the course of the pandemic, it's been released pretty much around the world. It was released in Europe and France and Italy. It was released, I think, first in New Zealand and Australia, and then into Asia before now showing up here in the United States and Canada. And the response has been good. You know, it's a very sort of specific, kind of culturally specific film, and yet I wanted it to kind of have a very sort of universal appeal in terms of, you know, everyone spent time alone in a scary place. And I wanted to kind of really play on those fears. So I've been happy with the response. Folks who are Jewish or understand some kind of what's in the film, I think they come away with it, maybe understanding some of the stuff more or seeing kind of the more subtle things. But then general audiences as well, I've been happy to hear that they've either been scared or enjoyed a sort of peek into this world that they weren't so familiar with.
Well, to give folks a little bit of background, the story is about a troubled young man, Jacob, who's having some financial difficulties, some adjustment difficulties to some tragedies in his life, and a friend of his from his previous Hasidic community offers him a way to make some money by participating in a ritual called a shomer, where someone watches over the body of someone who is newly deceased before the body is picked up at sunrise by the people taking him to be prepared for burial. Do I have that correct?
Yeah.
I want to make sure I pronounced it right. Shermer.
Yes. And there's a couple pronunciations in the film. You know, in the community, they say Shoimer. And then kind of in outside the community, a lot of folks say Shomer or Shomer, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And it's the movie is a fascinating look into, I don't want to give too many spoilers away, but not everything is dead in the house where Jacob is performing his ritual duties. And like for me personally, I, you know, like most mainstream Americans, have heard of the term sitting Shiva. I had actually never heard of this, and the part of me that grew up in the Black South goes, no, y'all don't mess with the dead after night, man. Not happening. But the richness of the folklore about this ritual and the creature was fascinating to me because I had never heard of it before, but I understood enough of what was coming across that there's a great big tie to grief and this monster and the benefits of letting go. So, like I said, without delving into spoiler territory, where did the inspiration for telling this particular story, this particular myth, legend from this point of view come from?
Yeah, so I had never been a Shomer before. I have friends and family who have, and it's relatively common. You're right, people hear a lot about sitting Shiva, but they don't often hear about this particular ritual, this particular, the vigil. But it is relatively common. I think maybe why people aren't that familiar with it is because in Jewish tradition, the body needs to be buried ASAP, as you know, there's no embalming, there's no open casket, anything like that. The body is put in the ground as soon as it can be, for all sorts of interesting reasons. But if the body can't be put in the ground the same day, or you know, in a certain spot, you have to have a shomer watch over. And in the kind of in the larger Jewish community, the little more liberal Jewish community, or secular, the shomer thing is usually a friend or family member. It's somebody who knows this person, and it usually in shifts. So someone's a shomer only for a couple hours. But in the Hasidic community, ultra Orthodox community, there are these paid shomers who do this, for a side living for people who just don't have anybody to watch the body. That idea was always fascinating. And I thought it's crazy that no one used that as a setup for a horror film yet. At the same time, once kind of I had that idea and thought, wow, this is a great setting, I didn't want to be crass or exploitative about it in terms of like sitting with the body and then, turn into Evil Dead antics or something. When it came time to figure out, I know how this ritual works. I know what the Shomer needs to do, and I know what's going on in the community. I had to figure out what the entity is. So what would be intrinsically Jewish that would be haunting this house? To figure that out, I had to do a lot of research. And in fact, the entity in the vigil is real. It's just incredibly obscure. And I think it itself speaks a lot to kind of Jewish traditions in terms of, in Judaism, the kind of the afterlife is different than in Christianity. There isn't a concept of a heaven and a hell the same way. There is not a devil the same way. So in terms of demons, they're not sent by a devil from hell to collect souls or to tempt people. The demons in Jewish mythology are much more, there's a very specific story that we can get into where they come from and why they exist, but they're much more like animals. It'd be like if you happen to come home and somehow a tiger escaped from the zoo and it was in your house. That's much more what these sort of entities are like. How do you deal with that? How do you escape? And so using that sort of framework, once we kind of had that idea and I had kind of discovered the creature, which in the film's called a mazik, which means destroyer in Hebrew, it was, then time to kind of wrap this entity and this concept of this thing directly into the themes of the film, into why Yaakov's there, into, the history of these people and this community, and the sort of fears and traumas that prey upon them and that have taken form as this thing.
Well, this thing, the mazik, was to me a very fascinating concept from how the widow, the old woman in the house, described it as something that comes to you because your grief and fear is calling it. And then it just kind of feeds on you until you die, however long that may take. I'm like, that is terrifying, especially the part where it says, Once it latches onto you, you can't get rid of it. So too bad for you if you don't realize what's happened until after your window of opportunity to escape from it is gone. Like, well, that's a little vindictive. But just the idea that there's this creature that comes to you because of your grief and fear that's emanating off of you, and it goes, ooh, lunch, and stays. It literally
latches on.
Yeah, it becomes like a sort of spiritual leech and stays there forever.
100%. Yeah, and it's interesting. Yeah, that leech sort of idea was very much, it kind of came up early. When I was doing the research on the Mazik, and I'd come across the name before, it's interesting, in the Hasidic community today, if a child is acting up at home and kind of creating a scene, the parents might say, you're being such a mazik, i.e. you're being unruly and you're creating trouble. But 2,000 years ago, the term, the word mazik had a more sinister connotation, in that in the rabbinic literature, it says that you should avoid abandoned houses, or don't go into that scary house because there could be a mazik in it. However, they never described what it looked like. It's just like, don't go in there because there's a mazik. And I guess, you know, most people be like, okay, I won't. So I love the idea, the name. I love the name of it and this sort of idea. And it was something that wasn't a Dybbuk. It wasn't a golem. It wasn't some kind of the traditional Jewish stuff that we associate with Jewish mythology. So when it came time to create the actual creature and kind of what it looked like and what it did, you know, it really, for me, it came down to, you know, both our main character's sort of trauma and the incident in his life that led to him getting into that. But at the same time, it was kind of like a way to explore the themes of the film more directly, in terms of the trauma that we experience holds us back and keeps us looking at it, in a sense. And I thought, if we can manifest that physically, if we can actually get into, make the mazik so that it appears as though it is stuck in the past and it can't move forward. And then if it latches onto you, that's exactly what it's going to do to you. It's going to make you relive the traumas, both your own, but also your ancestors. Stuff that it's fed on over time. It's going to make you see these things and experience, because it feeds on that pain. I thought, yeah, that sounded interesting and different. I hadn't seen that before. Of course, thinking of it was one thing, and then actually pulling it off was another.
Well, the fact that it's mostly obscured and mostly shadows, and lets your own imagination scare the living crap out of you with what it might really look at. But the description of it, of having its head turned backward, and having that echo in the people who it had attached to, being stuck in their pain and their grief, always looking back at that incident that caused that, was, you know, very fascinating to me. But what was even more frightening was realizing that you know, this isn't like other creatures in mythology or folklore, where you can have more than one chance to free yourself from it. This is one shot and you're toast. I'm like, that's horrifying. Where do these things come from? Where does that you have one chance before you're punished forever sort of... you can't call it a trope, because I had never heard of that before, but
right.
this sort of level of inability to forgive yourself and move on. You have one shot to let go or you're done. Where does that,
right.
I mean, does that echo through other Jewish legends and myths, or is that just something specific with this one creature?
You know, so I think it's kind of mixed. In some ways it was the Job story, in terms of why am I going through this? What is this doing to me? You know, what's the point of this suffering that's happening? And trying to explain that. At the same time, it was something specific that, I thought would be really interesting if, right, you had one shot. And it was almost like, in some ways, you could see it as the universe guiding Yaakov to this moment, right? And this sort of idea of, you have been burdened by this pain and this trauma and this guilt that you've felt for so long. Even though he's a young guy, you've been built with it for so long that it's kind of destroying your life. And here comes the door is opened. Here's an opportunity to change, to be able to move past it. And it's going to be freaky as hell, and it's going to really put you through the ringer. But if you can manage it, then all the possibilities are open. And I thought that was interesting, that kind of like the crucible, in a way, you're putting somebody in this crucible to see if they can make it out. And it's juxtaposed in some ways to the person who the Mazik was feeding on last, who was not able to do that, who was not able to move past that pain. And the other interesting idea that we kind of talked about was it doesn't kill you, it's just on you, it's just with you. And it's very much sort of like a physical representation of pain and trauma, how it's always with you. If you've experienced a traumatic event or you have PTSD or one of these things, you never get rid of it. There's no way to truly exercise it. You can't remove it, but you can learn to live with it and you can push through it. And so part of that was exploring that idea in terms of like as forcefully as possible.
So, talk a little bit about the design of the film itself. For me, the sound design and the soundtrack, the music served to increase the tension in an almost deliciously unbearable way because you could feel Jakob struggling. He's been dealing with some mental issues. He's been seeing a psychiatrist. He's been taking meds, and he's been financially bereft enough to where he actually states in the beginning, "I've been choosing between, food and my meds." And for a person with a condition, that can be a dangerous thing, because you're lowering your dosage in order to eat, and then that causes your brain to go, "Ooh, playtime."
All right. Yeah, and I
But
loved, that sort of setup of, it was when I was first talking to my producers about the film, and they were kind of putting their minds together in terms of like how to approach financiers and in terms of making it. One of the things they said is, Keith, if you could sum this film up in one word, what would that word be? Like, what are we supposed to get in terms of feel? And the word was dread. And so that became the sort of, for my director of photography, for production design, that was the kind of operative word. For me, I love tension. I like to, I think of it in terms of like a roller coaster. I like the part when you're going up the hill, when it's the kind of climb before you get to the top and you're expecting the fall. That's the richest part. When you fall, when you go over the other side of the roller coaster and you scream, that's cathartic. That's release. That's the end of the scare. That's when something jumps out of the dark. And that's primal. That's instinctive. You're not thinking, you're just reacting. But it's the lead up to that moment when you are thinking, when you're envisioning what is in the dark, what's there, what is that sound I hear? So all of that stuff was really integral to the story from the very beginning. And I wrote a lot of the sound design. I know it sounds kind of silly to write sound design, but I wrote the sound design into the script in terms of the sounds I wanted to hear. And we spent a lot of time in post-production, working with our team in terms of coming up with, making that house feel alive. When you're doing a contained film like this on a in a small space, you got to really kind of broaden this up sonically as much as you can. But to just always keep the dread coming in different waves, and then the color scheme and just all these pieces adding up to make it as uneasy as possible.
Well, for me, I'm not sure you and I watched the same movie, because the roller coaster, it would go up, 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 and then it would plateau, and then it would keep going up again and then plateau. And the release, the cathartic release, didn't come until the very end. So, yeah, that that was fun, unexpected, but a little bit fun, because there was no break. Because he's supposed to be there for 5 hours, just, you know, until sunrise, when the mortuary people come to take the body away. So it's very compressed, not only spatially, but time-wise. He's only there for a limited time, but what he's experiencing makes it feel like it's forever. And that tension, like you said, the soundscape of the sounds of the house, or the sounds not being in the house, combined with the music at certain points, at the very start where he gets to the house, you're not sure if his anxiety is causing him to see these things, or if he's really seeing these things. And I loved how that was played with, until you get to the point where, no, he's really seeing these things.
Yeah. No, and I love that stuff too. That sort of, it was kind of one of those things where I knew that the minute that he got in that house and the kind of the door was closed and he was there, that I wanted to start twisting and kind of, you know, twisting the screws down and keep them twisting until the very end. And in terms, you know, there were certain points in earlier drafts where I had kind of added breaks, where like little releases, and I took them out because I thought, well, you already had your break at the beginning. You know, you got a nice break getting to the house, but now that we're here, like, you're strapped in and this is it. And all those moments, it's interesting. Like, they're, a lot of them are wordless, which I liked a lot as well. And, you know, it came from a place of, you know, I guess being anxious just in my younger years, and having spent a lot of time just whatever, sleepless and up late and listening to the house and the wind and whatever outside. And, you know, your brain just runs riot. And I love the idea of that sort of, you know, getting us into that as quickly as possible, kind of establishing the crisis our character's going through. And then getting him to a point where he, you know, is going to have to be with himself. I suppose that's the scariest thing for, you know, in some ways, is being with yourself, and kind of, if it's just you in a body, there's a lot of introspection going on. And that, I like the idea that you could maybe read it initially as this is manifesting from his own, you know, 'cause he's alone and he's having these, he's hearing things and he's seeing things, and it has to do with his mental state. But at the end of the day, I wanted that all to be directly affected by the Mazik, who is, you know, has seen this broken person and said, oh, perfect. I'm gonna use this to my advantage.
Cool. So what else are you working on? Are you just focused on the vigil right now?
Yeah, so, you know, right now, right, this big push for the vigil in terms of getting the word out and, you know, hopefully people checking it out when it shows up online. And then at the same time, I am very involved in my next project, which will hopefully be shooting soon, which is a new adaptation of Stephen King's Firestarter.
Nice.
That I'm doing for Blumhouse and Universal. And yeah, no, it's great. It's I mean, it sounds very different than The Vigil, but I think a lot of the same kind of things are at work here in terms of, you know, The Vigil explores these themes of guilt and trauma and the psychology of people who are in crisis. And Firestarter does in some of the same ways. You know, it's about a family that's in crisis. There's not a supernatural entity that's after them, the supernatural aspects are within them, and the way they manifest is just as dangerous and just as traumatic in a way. So yeah, it was a great opportunity when the project was first kind of floated to me. It was one of the Stephen King books that I really liked. Mm-hmm. It was one of the first ones I actually read, and I came to King, I think, a little later than a lot of people. It was like, they were probably in middle school, late middle school, early high school. But I liked that it wasn't the sort of supernatural that you saw in The Shining or in It. It was much more grounded. I also have a background in science, and I did clinical research for a long time. And so that also had crazy parallels in that I used to do drug studies. And of course, the core of what has happened in Firestarter is a result of some nefarious drug studies. So there were a lot of interesting parallels, and I thought this sounded very cool. And luckily it has an amazing script by a guy named Scott Teams, who wrote the upcoming Halloween sequel. Mm. So Halloween Kills. And it's great. I'm really excited about it.
Cool. Well, like I said, Firestarter is also one of my favorites. I'm looking forward to what you guys do with that. But Keith, thank you so much for sharing your insight and passion for The Vigil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I'm so glad you enjoyed it. And it was really great talking about it.
And we shall return with more Slices Sci-Fi right after this.
Escape Pod is your destination for the best in modern short science fiction. Our intrepid crew of editors and hosts will bring you fun, thought-provoking in-flight entertainment every week as the pod careens around the multiverse. In the mood for a classic? We've got Anson Mount, also known as Captain Christopher Pike, reading Theodore Sturgeon. Want something a little more up-to-date? Jennifer R. Donahue's Surveillance Fatigue has you covered. In every sense. From classic space opera to intimate character drama. From heroic alien pets waiting for their families to herds of Einsteins and the benevolent conspiracy they're hatching, Escape Pod has it all. Take a ride with us at escapepod.org and buckle up, because it's story time.
This is Kevin Murphy from Mystery Science Theater 3000 and Rift Tracks, and you have bitten off a nice big chunk of Slice of Sci-Fi.
I could have talked to Keith about research and lore for at least another half an hour. And yes, I recommend checking out The Vigil. You should be able to find it on Apple TV, YouTube, Amazon Prime, many of the places you like to go for your digital movie consumption. And if you like horror movies that are on the more quiet, suspenseful, tension-building side, this one is right up your alley. Go see it. It is out now. And I do highly recommend it. What types of legends and lore and monsters are you seeking stories about? Do you like finding out stories about monsters you've never heard of before, that people believe exist in the world, that people believe you should be afraid of too, because it scares the ever-loving crap out of them, and they want to share that terror? Because maybe sharing that terror makes it less so for them? Anyway, if you have any questions or comments, please feel free to weigh in. Let me know. Send me an email, summer@sliceofscifi.com, or come on by the website, sliceofscifi.com. Leave a comment on this episode or any of the others where you have a question, or chat me up on Twitter. The handle is Slice of Sci-Fi, and I will talk about science fiction. I will talk about horror. I will talk about mysteries and thrillers. I will definitely talk about action movies and occasionally about baseball and soccer as well. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Player FM, and iHeartRadio Podcasts. And if you're listening on Apple or Stitcher, please leave us a review. Let folks know you are enjoying the show, and maybe they should give a listen themselves. I'd like to thank everyone who is currently supporting the show and all of the shows in the Slice of Sci-Fi universe, which include Writers After Dark and the Babylon Podcast. Your donations through PayPal, your pledges through Patreon do help keep the lights on around here. So thank you for your support. If you'd like to add your support, the place to go is patreon.com/sliceofscifi. Add yourself as a patron, pick a tier, any tier, and everyone who is a patron is eligible to win perks. Every month I pick a winning email address out of the basket, and that person gets to choose from a DVD, a Blu-ray, a book, many of the materials sent over the years. I gift them to you as my thanks for being a supporter, and you get swag and I get extra space, so we all win. If you'd rather help out every now and then instead of committing to a monthly pledge, the link to use is paypal.me/scifisummer. And I'd like to remind everyone that over at Escape Pod, a new call for submissions will open up on March 1st, so get those science fiction short stories ready. The instructions can be found over at escapepod.org. And that'll do it for this episode. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.